Welcome, FinTech Talkers, to another edition of the FinTech Talk Show, recorded at Money 2020, live in Las Vegas. I'm your host, Patty. My guest today is Ian Horn. He's the author of the about-to-be-published book, Why DeFi Matters, What Crypto Assets, Web3, and the Metaverse Really Mean for Finance. According to the book's preview on Amazon, which it's available now for pre-order, Ian examines the aspects of DeFi that will materially change financial systems and how they will alter the nature of purchasing, lending, insurance, and banking, the role of Web3 and the metaverse in this new era of finance, and its role in the democratization of finance. Welcome, Ian, to the FinTech Talk Show.
Hi, Patty. Nice to be with you. Thank you for inviting me on.
Sure. Yeah, it's fun. And before we get into the book and why you wrote it, Ian, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, sure. So I'll go through my professional background. I think that's the best way to do this. I currently work for Money 2020. I'm the European head of content there. So I work alongside Gina Clark, who's the content director, and Mickey Tesfaye, who's the content lead. And we basically have the role, and it's an incredible role, of setting the agenda for Money 2020 Amsterdam and finding ways to fill the stages with incredible speakers, the right topics, and also formatting these things, right? Finding the right blend of conversations, presentations, arguments, you name it. And that's an incredible thing to do. But that is my first full kind of fintech role. Prior to that, I spent 8 years at a company called Citywire. Now, my role there was as a relationship manager, actually. I had a job called audience development, which is a confusing, misunderstood, and not very commonly known role, where basically I would engage with the readers of our publication who were financial advisors and wealth managers. So that was my first real introduction to finance. It was an incredible thing to do. I loved kind of getting to know the investment market in the UK. And after 5 or 6 years of doing that, I got to a point where I really wanted to branch out and do something new. And there were so many different things that I kind of pitched to the management team. I really wanted them to, like, just, you know, give me something to run with. And the idea they really liked was the idea of looking more closely at fintech. And that began a kind of brilliant kind of professional love affair that took me to Money 2020. I started writing about technology in the wealth tech space for use both by professional investors, but also D2C investment tools and savings tools and things like that. And having gotten into that, having hosted a podcast called The Wealth Tech Show, that was around for about a year, and a newsletter on the same topic, I then realized that my career needed to be in fintech. I was finding it far too interesting, and it wasn't really the core business area of Citywire, my previous employer. So I departed on good terms, went to Money 2020, and 5 days after joining the company, I was here in Vegas, and that was last year. So that's kind of my journey so far. It's been really wild. I think the other thing that I'll say, other than, you know, mentioning working for Money 2020, which is an incredible company to work for, I mean, being part of this show really is something. The other thing I would say, though, is before that, when I was at university, I was studying sociology. Mm-hmm. Now, there seems to be a bit of a misconception sometimes, and UK politicians have talked about this a bit, that you kind of don't get anywhere with humanities subjects. In fact, I've just finished reading Michael Lewis's book on Sam Bankman-Fried, and there's a guy, SBF, who didn't really see any merit in the humanities. Now, I would like to make the case for the opposite. Mm-hmm. You know, I feel like if you understand people, you've got a far better chance of understanding finance, and I think fintech should serve human needs. So that was influential to me. But anyway, that's my career. That's what kind of matters to me, and here I am.
Awesome. Thank you, Ian. And there's a lot to unpack there. Actually, you covered a lot of things and wish that we had time to cover some of that. Maybe I'll try at the backside because we want to talk about your book.
Sure.
But briefly on the investment, and we'll do this later if you have time, kind of the role of Gen AI in some of content creation broadly, right?
Mm-hmm.
The event experience or the investment or wealth tech. Customers, right? How advisors, right? As talking to financial institutions, they are looking at Gen AI as a way to kind of be the voice. So it's an interesting time
for
of
sure.
The applications, yeah. But let's talk a little bit about your book and the enterprise DeFi. So a lot of content. Obviously, you had some wealth kind of exposure in your previous job. So what made you look into enterprise DeFi, Web3, and Metaverse?
Well, that's a good question. It started with cryptocurrency, and I remember around the time when, you know, Bitcoin's price started shooting through the roof. This was around the time I was working with financial advisors, and they were correctly saying to their clients, don't touch this stuff. Now, when I say correctly, I'm not talking about the investment return. I'm not saying that Bitcoin or crypto is good or bad here. But as you can imagine, if you're looking after someone's pension plan and it's 2016, 2017, 2018, you do not tell someone at the age of 55 or 60 to stick their pension in crypto, right? But it spurred all these fascinating conversations on Twitter and on LinkedIn. And I loved how divisive it was. I won't lie. When people were talking about crypto as being the best thing ever or the worst thing ever. And for years, I kind of just glanced at it and acknowledged it and saw the line going up and the line going down and thought, okay, this is quite good. And I had the idea to write a book about investing in crypto, but to kind of couch that in some general financial advice to help people understand how you should invest, because, you know, people have had financial ruin from getting into this. But then the idea kind of pivoted as my career pivoted, as I went from wealth tech towards fintech into Money 2020, where I've got a kind of, you know, better insight into the payments and banking world. I then thought, well, actually, the more you look at it, decentralized finance is really changing everything, you know, in its own way. I don't want to be too hyperbolic, but it is, you know, it's transformational technology. And I thought, actually, it's a better story to tell, and thankfully my publisher agreed. And so, yeah, there was a lengthy pitch, and then, well, that was sent to them, you know, in a document, and they said, yeah, go for it. And then I'm really glad, because I think finance is interesting, technology is interesting, but what's incredible about DeFi and why I wanted to kind of immerse myself in it is it has so much more to it than just technology. It has so much more to it than just finance. It's social, it's political. The implications of DeFi are massive and very interesting. So it just seemed like something to really tackle. And I spent the first 6 months of this year with my head buried in papers, reading this stuff and writing about it. And it was, you know, an incredible experience.
Gotcha. No, very interesting. And what Ian and I are talking about is not to be considered investment advice, meaning whatever your personal situation is, you talk to advisors. This is just for information and entertainment purposes. But I can hear the passion in your voice, Ian. Obviously, you got into it. The crypto and stuff. So before we get too deep into it, can you, some of our audience, most of them are kind of fintech and associated, so they might know. Mm-hmm. But briefly, if we can kind of establish some definitions. So when we say DeFi, when we say Web3, sometimes interchangeably I've heard, and metaverse, right? Can we define those three terms?
Yes. And where should we start? I think I'll start with the metaverse. And the metaverse is an interesting one. I note this in the book, that no one really seems to be agreed on what constitutes a fully working metaverse. Mm-hmm. The closest I've seen is Matthew Ball's book on the metaverse that offers a very good and well-explained, you know, description of what it might be. I tend to think of it as basically the increasing immersion into virtual reality and augmented reality, and everyone calls that now extended reality. So, you know, the idea that we'll spend more of our lives in virtual worlds online, and this might become part of our, you know, a bigger part of our social lives and our professional lives too. So I kind of see the metaverse as the digital universe. Now, people add other elements into that. I mean, one of the most popular things people think about is interoperability, and the longevity of the things that you own. So the idea that if I own something in the metaverse, I can take that property with me to different, you know, virtual worlds within the metaverse and so on. That is a challenging concept for all sorts of technical reasons. For instance, if I have something in a game that's like a sports game and I then take it into World of Warcraft or something like that, it makes that's no right. sense. Yeah. But I think if you try and like create the perfect definition for it, it's not going to make sense. For the metaverse, I basically just see it as the increasing growth and importance of virtual reality or extended reality, therefore, in our lives. And that is a whole, and that's a really significant thing, because that's a whole new play area. It's a whole new sandbox for commerce, for finance, for you know, you name it, anything.
Yeah, and gaming is a big
Gaming is a huge part of that, and gaming, of course, ties into all these other things too. Right. Mm-hmm. So that's the metaverse. And you're really right to say that Web3 and DeFi get mentioned interchangeably. And again, I do see Web3 sometimes as a slightly woolly term. Web3, you know, is essentially the blockchain internet. It's the idea of decentralized ownership and you know, making use of the immutability and the basically the properties of the blockchain to create systems that are that are theoretically more equitable and fairer. Again, people kind of take this idea and run with it. I mean, again, it's the blockchain internet. I think that's the best way of looking at it. Mm-hmm. There's a million and one alleyways you could go into from there. And DeFi is part of that. I would say DeFi certainly is the financial element of blockchain internet. And yeah, so DeFi, it represents more than just that, though, doesn't it? It's the introduction of blockchain into our financial world. The idea that you can, with blockchain and smart contracts, create a whole financial ecosystem that exists of itself and can run kind of by itself, mm-hmm. And doesn't rely on the traditional financial world necessarily. So it's a lot to unpack, and I sort of wish I didn't try to unpack so much stuff because I did a lot of reading at the start of this year. But that, broadly speaking, is what we're dealing with.
So, but that's why people should buy your book and read your book.
Yes.
And we're giving
buy three copies.
And you're given some preview here. But that's I love your definitions, if I can kind of paraphrase or summarize. So Web3 is the bigger blockchain internet, it's mm-hmm. the evolution of the internet. DeFi is almost a subset, kind of the financial piece of that. And Web3 kind of is more democratized. I think the preview had that word, not only financial services, but maybe broadly on the internet. And metaverse is more kind of the experience, right?
Yeah.
Virtual and other things. So if you take each one at a time, maybe get into DeFi, because I want to talk about that. We're at Money 2020, mm-hmm. and we want to talk about fintech. Traditionally, fintech has innovated at the distribution, right, removing friction, and not attempted to replace central bank function or the factory, if you will, of financial services. DeFi is an attempt to kind of rewrite, at least to some extent, that.
Yeah.
So you can't just do distribution. You can innovate at the fringes, but if you're changing the whole thing, then you have to kind of uproot the whole thing or redo the whole thing. And that might be what we're seeing now, right? There's a lot of friction and political kind of battles, which are seen as enforcement actions and stuff. But what do you think about that? Do we need a little bit more level setting about that for DeFi to get mainstream, or where do you see this?
Yeah, it's a lot to unpack, and you're touching upon all the right things, I think. Mm-hmm. I think the challenge, really, if we go back to the real heart of it, is that for me, DeFi represents a new form of money in its own way. Like, it's money that you can program. It's like money brought into the digital age. We have, we do have digital money in a sense. So I'm from the UK, where 5% of money, I think, is cash and banknotes, whatever. 95% is technically digital. But it's not DeFi. It's not programmable in that same way. In a way, I think people have realized that you have money as data, but actually that means you can do a lot more with it. And that puts you into there's two strands of thought to that. One is that, oh, wait a second, technology now allows us to create our own financial ecosystem that will possibly self-sustain itself outside of central banks, outside of other groups. That's the kind of more radical idea of DeFi. And then the other side of it, quite frankly, is that, okay, money's upgraded now, so how do we integrate that within existing financial systems? So I think there are competing claims on the future here. There's competing ideas. And I think, obviously, DeFi's come up. People have created their own new currencies. But that actually raises huge questions around, what is currency, for instance. Currency is, only currency if people, only kind of valid if people agree that it's valid. So how can you conjure up something, a system of value just out of nothing? And I think there are ways to do it, and people are attempting to do it. Bitcoin and Ether, I would say, have achieved it.
Quite a bit. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they were almost worth $1 trillion, almost there now again, or getting there,
Absolutely. So we now have the technology to create informal currency zones or at least networks. Mm-hmm. And that's a really substantial thing, and unsurprisingly, traditional finance is looking very closely at it. Regulators are confused as hell, as well they should be. and that's the state of play, really.
Yeah, and we should mention that Bitcoin's treated, at least by the regulators, as commodity, not as currency. So they regulate it as commodity. But it's an interesting point. It's gotten the critical mass, and it's the trust that you rightly point out, right? What people believe in. In terms of the friction, and we touched, or you touched a little bit on the central banking aspect. Mm-hmm. I think we've not seen a system outside of that, so to speak, and the central bank has functioned. There's not really a competition for that, mm-hmm. right? It has the role of the Fed and things like that. So we probably don't see that going away, right? So DeFi mm-hmm. has to exist within that framework, or you see this kind of maybe evolving over time where you might have it in a different jurisdiction?
These are huge questions, and I have no idea how it plays out. If I had to guess, I can see a role for both coexisting, but maybe, you know, I think the co-mingling of the two will be, I wouldn't expect to be massively significant. I think if you look at something like a stable coin, mm-hmm. especially the ones that rely on, you know, something like the US dollar and treasuries and so on.
Pegged to the dollar or yeah. pegged to any fiat.
Yeah. yeah, then I can see that kind of collision where things work together. But it's tricky. When we talk about what this means for central banks, it's a massive question. And it really depends which currency you're in, how dollarized it is, or how much economic sovereignty it has.
Yeah.
So, I think DeFi exists of itself and should exist of itself as part of a diverse money supply. I can get into that at another point. But yeah, like you say, the idea of removing the economic sovereignty of governments and of central banks is a tricky thing. It really depends on where you live and if you want that. I wouldn't expect it to happen anytime soon, you know, in Europe, in US or the UK. It would require something major for that to happen.
Gotcha. And it has to evolve and in the thinking and stuff. But you did say something around programmability. I want to touch on that a little mm-hmm. bit, because that's a powerful concept. Because we, even when during the COVID, the government was kind of getting money out to businesses to support them mm-hmm. to stay afloat and stuff. If they had, say, programmable money, they could say that, oh, you can use this money only for payroll, for example.
Yeah.
That's a very powerful tool to have, right? And you can't do that with current money, right? I mean, mm-hmm. that you can, but they have to kind of make sure with receipts, like what you do for taxes and stuff like that. It's after the fact. So I think it's a powerful concept, but I don't think governments... Well, there's CBDC. Do you want to touch on that?
Yeah, I do. Yeah. CBDCs are such an interesting conversation. I think what's interesting about all of these areas of crypto, actually, crypto, DeFi, and CBDCs, people talk about them as uniform concepts, and they aren't. For me, a central bank digital currency is going to represent the interest of that central bank and what it's trying to do. So a central bank digital currency that's British would be very different to one that was American, to Chinese, to Indian, to, you know, you name it. I think the idea of programmable money is really interesting. As you say, the opportunity is that you could create better systems of welfare. You could, you know, create economic stimulus packages that would actually be quite directed and specific and therefore potentially more useful. But there's that fear, isn't there? There's that fear that people have that once a government can control your money that way, that they will overstep those boundaries. They will kind of, well, they'll breach your privacy. They'll possibly remove your liberty, or they'll create money that they say you can spend it when we say you can spend it. And it becomes incredibly paternalistic if you follow that line of thought. I think it's a valid fear. I really do. I don't think, you know, if you do upgrade money, you change money in this way and that becomes the normal thing, that is a legitimate concern. I wouldn't expect most central banks to operate in that manner. I wouldn't expect most nations, especially where you've got a relatively strong democracy, I wouldn't expect them to introduce something like that that people don't want. I mean, there have been public consultations on this. I mean, in the EU, interestingly, there was a consultation on what your concerns are about CBDCs, and privacy, by and large, came out as the big concern. At the same time, that same study showed that the majority of respondents worked within fintech, and most of them were guys. So, I mean, it probably gives you an indication of who's looking at this stuff, and possibly that a few groups were corralled into all voting and saying, like, you know, no privacy problems. It's a tricky one because I can't foresee what a government's going to do with that money. And once you do open that door, there is the argument that you can't close it. Right. So it's interesting. But I hope that in nations where democracy is strong and you can hold governments accountable, that something like this could be rolled out in a way that's completely reasonable.
Right.
And of course, there's a distinction between wholesale and retail CBDCs. Wholesale, deals with kind of wholesale payments, massive, large, chunky payments. That, I don't think, is anything to be concerned about. If we have transparency in how large financial institutions are spending money, that's good.
Right.
Retail CBDCs, there's a distinction. That's what people are concerned about. Everyday payments being programmed, being watched, all of that stuff. Again, I think your response to that is going to be based on your politics and where you're from in life and what faith you have in your government.
That's right. And in the US, we're already seeing some of that political kind of discussions around CBDC, the retail CBDC, mm-hmm. as you said. Yeah, the wholesale is kind of more streamlining or removing or creating efficiencies in settlement and clearing that nobody would have objections to. That's fascinating. So conceivably, these could all coexist, and which one gets more adopted more, it depends, right?
And another issue there is interoperability. It's a word I end up saying a million and one times on podcasts like this, and it's a really chunky word, isn't it? But the idea that if I have a CBDC, should that therefore be able to interact with foreign currencies? There's actually an argument for keeping these things domestic and then, you know, using them for government-influenced things. There's also an argument that says, oh, this could be really great if we've got good trading partners. We can have, you know, smoother commerce, especially like, you know, you could possibly do that in a kind of B2B sense with other nations that you have good relationships with. But, I mean, that's one for another day. But there are they call them MCBDC projects. The M just stands for multiple. Right. There's loads going on. And it's good to point people in the right direction for information here. If you're interested to know what's going on in CBDCs, the place to check is the Atlantic Council's CBDC tracker. That is a really good resource.
Okay.
And it's not just, you know, listing what's going on. It's got a big map, which is great if you've got a short attention span. Mm-hmm. So it's I think the crucial thing is, when we talk about this and its impact, is that there's over 100 nations either using these already, piloting them or researching them with a view to potentially using them. Now, the majority of these are in the research or pilot stage rather than actually using them. Nigeria uses one, Bahamas uses one, the Eastern Caribbean Currency Union uses them. We haven't quite got that mass adoption of them yet, but the world is looking.
It'd be fascinating to see, and I'll look up the Atlantic Council. That's a good. The deficit issue is always there. You want things summarized?
Oh, absolutely. Give me a pictogram, please. Yeah.
Yes. So let's kind of talk about Web3 a little bit. And I like the way you kind of subsetted them. Right, the Web3 is kind of almost the evolution of the internet,
mm-hmm.
financial services, the DeFi part is just a subset. So. If the evolution of the internet, I look at internet companies, the search, social media, and even mm-hmm. the platform companies like Uber and others. So they dominate, or they have the models for commercialization of the internet.
Yeah.
So with kind of the evolution into Web3 or more equity-based model, where potentially the consumers of the internet can monetize mm-hmm. them rather than these central hubs, right?
Yeah.
Where search and social media and discovery like Uber, Airbnb. So any thoughts on that, of how that could potentially change the business model of the internet?
Yeah, I think there's a few things there. There's the idea that you can, there's also these different models of using things on Web3 where you'd play a game and earn money for doing it, and things like Axie Infinity introduced a while back. I know that didn't go particularly well in the end, but... It's a really interesting idea that you can create new ways of doing things where there isn't this centralized platform that has the power, and we're all free to kind of basically own our content. I think that's the thing. It comes down to content ownership, and it comes down in another level to tokenization and being able to token your asset. Yeah, so tokenize your assets or your content, whatever,
mm-hmm.
on a blockchain. It's an interesting model. I still see it as being very nascent. I think people say Web3 and throw it around like it's this brilliant cure-all, and I think we haven't really begun to see the start of it yet, because displacing Web2 models is difficult. Like you say, people like Uber or YouTube or Twitch or whoever, I mean, the the monopoly these people have is going to take some time to displace, if it's going to be displaced at all. But there is a really interesting point there. When you look at the cuts, you know, if you look at the creator economy, for instance, I think YouTube takes, I forget off the top of my head, but I think it's north of 30% or north of that of creator revenue. Same for Apple, same for Amazon. So anything you buy from those, you know, app stores, you're already paying quite a high tariff on that. And quite understandably, people are saying, well, actually, if we can create a blockchain-based system where there is none of that fee, and we can share that platform together, and we can build that platform together, I can see why there's a lot of merit in that idea.
Yeah, definitely. Meaning it's the economics that's sprucing the discussion. Obviously, the people talk about the creator's economy and so on. But I think there are some other issues maybe that need to be sorted out, like serviceability, who owns the serviceability and accountability and things. And maybe that will mature over time, and we'll see more models like that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think another thing with Web3 is, it's nice to say something's Web3, but these things need to speak to people. They need to solve human problems. They need to actually be valuable. So I think Web3 will if it does really take hold, will take hold, and people just find a product that really works for them, and they like it, and they use it, and they don't even think of it as being Web3.
Yeah.
It's also, you know, it's difficult to get people to buy into these shared platforms. Because I've seen some people try some ambitious things with music, for instance, where the idea is that, you know, people get paid hardly anything when someone listens to their music on Spotify or on YouTube. The idea that the creators can earn significantly more is a great idea. But then where do people go to for their music? Who has created that aggregation platform that people actually want to see? And again, the it's going to take a long time if it happens to displace the people that, you know, that own these music catalogs. Yeah. So imagine starting a new, you can say, I'm going to start a new platform, but if no major artists on it, it's going to be very hard to make that work.
Yeah.
But again, it's really early days. These things are all, a good idea could become a reality if enough people buy into it.
Right, right. And it's distribution, but it's also risk and curation and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and accountability, as you mentioned, is really important. So there's a whole chapter in the book devoted to DAOs, which are decentralized autonomous organizations.
Uh-huh.
And the idea of these is they're decentralized organizational structures that basically allow you to govern either a financial protocol or an app or whatever without there being like one person in charge. Every kind of major decision is subject to a vote. Now, what's interesting about that is the concept of it is really interesting. The idea that people who are in charge of something are genuinely accountable to broader society, or generally accountable to the people that use their product or whatever it is. That's a great idea. But the reality is that things are never perfectly decentralized, and that these organizations, it's all well and good to say I've created a DAO, but DAOs are not one and the same. And I think if you're someone that finds this kind of stuff interesting, I would recommend just delving into that chapter and getting an understanding of the very different ways in which these structures operate. Because if someone says I've made a DAO, that could take so many different forms.
Right, right, right. And the whole jurisdiction, and there's Balaji, I don't know whether you know, like he tweets quite a bit on these things, or X's, whatever.
Let's say tweets. I can't get my head around X's. Posts.
Posts. So he talks, and I've talked about it too, but he talks quite a bit about these digital jurisdictions, which is in some ways DAOs, right? In the U.S. at least, I know the state of Wyoming, I think, recognizes, but none of the other states. So kind of that construct has to be more accepted in legal jurisdictions, which is very early stages now. I mean, some states are recognizing, obviously, federal and maybe other countries. I think Europe has more adoption, I think, of DAOs and stuff. Yeah,
yeah, it does. I think Switzerland has created more understanding around that as well. It is tricky because, these regulators don't understand or aren't, and understandably are slow to move to recognize something like a DAO. And I can see why that happens as well, because we want people that run these things, but often on-chain governance is done pseudonymously. People don't necessarily want to reveal who they are. And also the idea of accountability, when it's meant to be a community that governs itself, it can be a kind of slightly tricky concept. Yeah. But again, there's DAOs and there's DAOs. I mean, there are DAOs that are trying to reshape the financial system. There are DAOs that are trying to create platforms for things. There are DAOs that are doing some cool kind of charitable work or kind of regenerative finance or trying to improve their local societies. So then, like I say, they're really not all one and the same, but I can see why it's a challenge for people to create any kind of legal clarity around what they are.
Yeah, well, we should get your book and read that chapter.
Yeah, please do. Again, buy 3 copies. I was very specific about that.
Sure. I think you, while writing book, you might have researched any examples you want to share, especially on Web3 or DeFi projects that you're excited about? Or
Well, yeah, I think on DeFi, I'm really intrigued by the by the established stable coins, actually, because I think the potential for cross-border and business-to-business payments, which again, maybe domestic or cross-border, is massive there. The idea that we can settle things quickly and cheaply as well is really quite something. I think that will have a big impact on treasury management and also potentially people's ability to access credit in time. There's always this kind of, well, people talk about the ability of blockchain to process things and its environmental downsides. But I think another thing I would look at is the improvement of blockchains. There are people building both new layer one blockchains. You know, you think of Bitcoin and Ethereum as layer ones. You know, people are, you know, there are loads of different options now, many of which are more efficient and scalable and allow for quicker transactions. And then also people are building layer twos on top of especially the Ethereum value machine. So we've got loads of things going on there. I think it's worth looking at that because it's very easy to slate things for how they are now. But there's so much work and resource being put into improving the actual infrastructure of the blockchain, essentially. So that's one thing I would look at. I mean, the early days for decentralized lending have been interesting too. You look at a company like Aave,
yeah.
You know, they're fantastic, and what they do is, in a way, financially, it's relatively boring. It's over-collateralized lending, but it's quite clever in its own way. It's not trying to do too much, and it works, and it's been sustainable for many years now. And obviously, if you're looking to grow a new token or kind of attract people to something, the idea of staking is quite interesting. I mean, I'm not always sold on it because you're basically trying to get people to chuck money at something until it's sustainable, which is, you know, it can look like a Ponzi and often can be a Ponzi, let's be real. But I think those innovations are interesting. And then one thing that I really think is a massive market, and Citi recently published a paper on this, is tokenization of real world assets. I mean, tokenization in general is massive. The idea that we can, you know, first you've got the online web economy, the idea that people can basically get NFTs within games, and people have been talking about this week in particular,
right,
is massive. But then there's also companies like DeFacto Labs who are taking bonds and tokenizing those, and then that, you know, it just improves the speed and the efficiency of the whole thing. It improves the settlement. You know, the activities of large institutions in space is interesting too. I mean, look at, you know, PayPal have invested in Aptos for the blockchain. You've got you know, even if it's not DeFi, people making use of this stuff, like JP Morgan, its Onyx division has JPM coin for international settlements. There are so many examples already where both kind of DeFi natives and traditional finance natives are already integrating the technology of DeFi to reduce costs, improve efficiencies, and I think we're only seeing the start of that now. I think the other thing with it is sometimes you just don't notice it. You know, blockchain, it's ridiculous in a sense that it's an improvement in ledger technology. It's an improvement to the way we can do, you know, accountancy in a sense. So it's both incredibly interesting if you're in finance and also incredibly boring if you're not. So I think some of the impacts of it we won't notice. Take an NFT in the future, we won't necessarily, oh yeah, I bought an NFT. I don't think it'll work like that. You know, Starbucks use it for loyalty cards. You know, so that those are the kind of examples that we've got. And I realize I've gone all over the shop talking about these things in a slightly rambling way. But it's, you know, I'm working at Money 2020 right now. So the show is on. But hopefully that makes some sense to some people.
No, it totally. And that were great examples, meaning you hear only about the failures, right? And we should talk about them too. But great examples, right? JP Morgan, Starbucks, they're actively using some of the things you're mm-hmm. talking about in successful initiatives, right? And maybe it's efficiency, maybe it's a better way of doing things like mm-hmm. cross-border payments in JP Morgan's case or loyalty in Starbucks' case. But people hear about FTX and the Ripple, so and things like that. Although Ripple's having some good news off late, I hear. Mm-hmm. But from some say it's hostile regulators trying to enforce, or bad news like FTX and other things that happen. That's what changes the kind of perception that all this is not good, right?
Yeah.
So what do you think are some of the biggest hurdles, and what should kind of the industry do to kind of clear some perceptions?
Yeah, that's a Pandora's box of things, isn't it? That let's start with FTX. FTX is a really interesting case because mm-hmm. you've got a company that actually was performing very successfully as a crypto exchange. The things that went wrong with it, as far as I can tell, were poor governance and slightly madcap leadership. And I think I'm being polite. I mean, it's really confusing to know what to think about these things. But I don't think FTX failed because it was crypto, although I think it was able to get away with quite a lot of things because it was crypto. Because it's so confusing to so many people, if you were trying to conduct a scam or pull the wool over people's eyes or simply get away with shoddy financial management, crypto kind of gives you a smokescreen for that. So you might not even be a bad faith actor, but you can probably get away with a few things, you know. It's tricky because regulators need to react to this, right? And there's different approaches. I mean, FTX had the Bahamas obviously looking after them, and the Bahamas went out of their way to create a clear legal system for crypto. They really made an effort to understand this, embrace it, and adopt it. And, you know, people in crypto think that's a really good thing. That will bring revenues to places like the Bahamas. It will encourage and foster innovation in this space, which is a great thing. At the same time, you're inheriting this new industry that hasn't quite grown up yet. So the SEC's attitude, you mentioned Ripple, I mean, they're moving understandably slowly, but I don't think there does appear to be, I do detect an agenda here, though. I do get the impression they don't really like crypto. I don't think it's their role to take a stance on that, and I'm happy to be corrected if that's wrong. But you look at the Ripple situation, what's interesting about that to me is they're spending a long time trying to figure out if XRP is a security or not. It really shouldn't be that confusing or that difficult to figure it out. And I think if it does take that long to make that decision, then I think the Howey test that we're using, you know, for securities is possibly the wrong way of deciding it, or maybe we need to classify it as something different entirely. You know, I just don't understand how that conversation can go on for that long. Although, admittedly, I'm not American. I don't know the concept. I don't know if this is something that's happened before. It doesn't seem like it has. It seems quite novel to me.
Yeah. I've had a take on this. Man, we're not lawyers, so there's obviously legal kind of aspects to it. But I think it's just it's a new thing, like you say, so maybe it needs a new classification. But it's basically policy issues. Obviously, some people like it, some people don't. But it's being settled sort of in a regulatory enforcement in the courts, which is not the right way to settle policy differences, right? Democracy kind of legislate, mm-hmm. create new laws and things like that. And maybe some of that will happen eventually. Some people try to do that. But that's a bigger question. And we can't solve it, but I think Ripple and Coinbase, I see them on Twitter, they're very actively kind of pushing their point of view, which is good for them, meaning if they believe strongly on that and they're not kind of, they don't think they're doing anything wrong, they're mm-hmm. trying to help with innovation and stuff, so more power to them. This lovely, we could go on, but I know it's late and you have the conference to take care of tomorrow as well. So in closing, Ian, where do you see this all going? Meaning, I think there was a crypto winter, or we're still in it, mm-hmm. even though it's fall and coming to the next year. Although some of the crypto assets like Bitcoin's kind of coming back up, so I don't know if that's the barometer or is it more widely. But where do you see everything going? You see everything coming back, or more regulation and policy? I know there were some tracks on Money 2020 around that I didn't attend. Yeah. But where do you see this going forward?
Yeah, that's, again, another big question. I think that's what I love about this topic. There are no simple questions, are there? I don't think crypto's going away. I think it's globally used, and so many people have so much invested in it already. Just making that go away or saying it's illegal, I don't think it's that easy. And it is just data in a way. You're kind of making data illegal. I think that's a confusing and difficult thing to do. And even in nations where crypto's banned, like China, I think roughly 2% of the population still holds some. So it's really difficult to make this thing go away. I know people look at crypto, especially Bitcoin, in terms of these high prices, these high, high valuations. I can't speak to that, to be honest. I don't really know where that's going, but I do expect it to endure. I don't expect Bitcoin to go away. I think it still has massive utility, and it really depends on your circumstances. I mean, I think it's easy, especially we're in the rooms we're in today, and we're in, largely people who are treated well by the financial system. We can forget what people's relationship to traditional finance is. And that might be based on their kind of social background, or it might be based on where they are in the world. Now, some of the extreme examples I kind of touch upon in the book are, how crypto has been used for earthquake relief in Syria, mm-hmm. How it was used in Ukraine to get money to the front lines far quicker than any bank ever would, mm-hmm. And how it was used in Afghanistan, where, the Taliban took over. Women can't have bank accounts, but if they have a crypto wallet, obviously they've got a way around it. So there is value, there is utility in this system. Mm-hmm. Now, the problem is the more you plug into that, the more philosophical you get. You start asking questions like, if it's illegal, is that a good or a bad thing? But then when do I want to do something illegal? So on. It gets too much. But I think there's too much that's been created for crypto to go away. And I think the bigger story that I kind of tell in the book is that the technology of decentralized finance, it represents an upgrade to money itself. And it allows us to do new things. And I think also this whole idea of Web3, the part that I didn't really talk about so much was open source architecture. The idea that people are building this code and they're sharing this code, and there's a community of people steadily increasing, improving it and building upon it. Now, for finance, the idea that you have these financial mechanisms that are steadily being improved. And by improved, that could be something as simple as just adding nuance to it and creating specific financial protocols and applications for different industries or different jobs or just very, or the creator economy or whatever, you name it. I think the technology of DeFi has already been transformational, and I'm really excited to see where it goes next. I'm not so bothered about the price of Bitcoin. That will do what it's going to do, I don't know. But what I think is going on here is far, far bigger than all of that.
That's a great way to put it, right? Meaning it's, a lot has come out of it and where the applications are. I guess this regulatory and policy stuff needs more clarity, and that's where maybe the development will be. No, that's awesome, Ian. How can people find you? Where, like, obviously Money 2020, but you're on X or Twitter, LinkedIn.
Never off of X. No, do you know what? I don't post on X so much these days. Basically, okay. But I am on it. You can find me. I'm _ Ian Horn mm-hmm. on that. I may one day return to tweeting or posting or Xing. I'm on LinkedIn. I welcome all follows and connection requests. I'm generally very friendly with that. Again, just search my name. There's a lovely picture of me smiling in a yellow backdrop, so that's me. And I am always willing to meet people that are innovating in this space or have something to say. And when I set out to write about it, I wanted to write a really balanced story. So even if you don't like it, reach out. I'm interested in all opinions, because I think if you're going to come to any kind of academic understanding of it, you've got to try and assess this for what it is. Final thing, the book is available on Amazon. It's called Why DeFi Matters. Although you can go directly to my publisher, which is Kogan Page. If you use the code DeFi20, that should be good for 20% off.
Awesome. That's great. So we should get 3 copies, as Ian said, but definitely get one.
One is fine. I'll drop it now. You've listened to the end, so one is fine.
Okay, thanks, Ian, for being on the FinTech Talk Show.
Thank you, Paddy. Pleasure.
Okay.